which in a sense is what we're trying to do. I hope it doesn't give you the wrong idea, as though we're sort of going at it hammer and tongs, or we're doing it in a way that is aggressive or hostile, not in a sense speaking the truth in love. But what we're trying to do is deal with the whole issue of secularism, because it's the prevailing worldview in our culture, and we need to be able to undermine it, and we need to be able to demonstrate that it's false. But in order to do that, we do need to understand something of the historical background of how we've got into the situation that we're in. Why is it that secularism has become the prevailing worldview? Given that, as Jock was saying, that there was a time when Christianity was the prevailing worldview, not always perfectly practiced by any means, but nonetheless, its basic tenets were taken for granted. And that, of course, now is very much not the case. We're a marginalized minority. To be a Christian, in some senses, is to be an oddity, almost. So, for example, there was absolutely no mention of Christianity in the European Constitution when that was being formulated, of the European Union, which, given that the European Union, in a sense, stands on the foundations of Christendom, is absolutely bizarre and absurd. But it's a kind of tribute to the extent to which our culture has rejected Christianity altogether. Or again, if you consider consider the whole emphasis on multiculturalism, that we're told that we're living in a multicultural society. Well, in a sense, of course, that's an absolute... in one way, if we're talking about a tolerant society of other cultures, that's fine. But if you're actually talking about a multicultural society in which all cultures are regarded as on the same level, you've relativized everything. In other words, there is no one culture that stands above another. They're all the same. They're all saying the same, whether they're Marxist, Hindu, Buddhist, Islamic, or Christian. And that's ridiculous. Intellectually, that's just ridiculous. And yet people say, we're living in a multicultural society. And they actually mean by that that ultimately we're living in a society of total relativism. Some of the fallout of that has now been recognized, and it was interesting to see that the head of the Commission of Racial Equality recently denounced multiculturalism as being something which, even though it had been the most fashionable thing and the thing that everyone was saying that our society was, he now said, oh, it's got problems. We don't really want that because it's causing social integration and ethnic fragmentation. But the fact that people sort of even, in some senses, marginalize Christianity, say that, oh, we're now a multicultural society. We're also in a society which completely stamps all over Christian ethics. You can just think of the whole abortion issue. Or you can think of the fact that cabinet ministers are quite happy to describe themselves as being homosexual. It's no big deal. And in fact, it's a sign of just how tolerant and how advanced and how progressive we are. So we are a minority. We are living in a secular society. How have we got like this? How has this come about? Because we need to be able to understand it in order to be able to develop our apologetic. We need to be able to see what were the reasons that led to this secularism, because we need to be able to, because those reasons are still alive and well, as in a sense. There's still reasons that people give for not being Christians. And we need to be able to answer them. And it's helpful to be able to see the kind of context in which they came about. And we need to ask ourselves, are any of the reasons that were given, are they decisive? Were they good reasons? are we, in a sense, going against reason by holding on to our Christian faith? Are we the kind of remnant of the people who stick their head in the sand and who are determined not to listen to what everyone else is listening to? Or actually, are we holding on to something which is fundamentally true? So are we a real Christian remnant? So in a sense, yes, I mean, we need to take that radical step of just questioning, have we got it right? Because that's what our friends and that's what our relatives, that's what our non-Christian contemporaries think about it. So we need to be able to ask ourselves, well, are they right? I don't think they are at all. But we need to be able to answer them. Now, the whole story of the rise of secularism is mostly one of Victorian doubt. Not entirely, and we'll see that it goes back further than that, but it is primarily one of Victorian doubt. And you might just like to pass around this picture, which was called The Doubt, painted in 1856 by a chap called Bowler. If you just pass that round, and you see that it's a Victorian woman looking at a grave and wondering, can the resurrection be true? Because she's looking at some bones, and there's a real sense of how can it possibly be true in the face of the reality of death? Now, actually, the painting is a little bit more optimistic than you might imagine, because there is, I think, on the skull, if you look very carefully down at the bottom, a little blue butterfly. Can you see that? Which actually is a symbol of the resurrection. So, but nonetheless, it was asking the question, that painting. It was kind of recognizing that this was a real issue for people in the 19th century. And perhaps more negatively, but more famously, there was the famous poem by Matthew Arnold in 1867 called Dover Beach, which I'm going to read, because I think it captures up this whole theme of Victorian doubt. The sea is calm tonight. The tide is full. The moon lies fair upon the straits. On the French coast the light gleams and is gone. The cliffs of England stand, glimmering and vast, out in the tranquil bay. Come to the window. Sweet is the night air. Only from the long line of spray where the sea meets the moon-blanched land, listen. You hear the grating roar of pebbles which the waves draw back and fling at their return up the high strand, begin and cease, and then again begin with tremulous cadence slow and bring the eternal note of sadness in. Sophocles long ago heard it on the Aegean, and it brought into his mind the turbid ebb and flow of human misery. We find also in the sound a thought, hearing it by this distant northern sea. And that thought is this. The sea of faith was once, too, at the full, and round the earth's shore lay like the folds of a bright girdle furled. Of course, the sea of faith is Christianity. But now I only hear its melancholy, long withdrawing roar, retreating to the breath of the night wind, down the vast edges drear and naked shingles of the world. Our love, let us be true to one another, for the world which seems to lie before us like a land of dreams, so various, so beautiful, so new, and listen to this, hath really neither joy, nor love, nor light, nor certitude, nor peace, nor help for pain. And we are here as one on a darkling plain, swept with the confused alarms of struggle and flight, where ignorant armies clash by night. It's a wonderful and a tragic depiction of the despair, in a sense, when you believe, and you cannot believe in God, you cannot believe in Christianity. There is absolutely no hope. There's a recognition right early on in the whole thing of doubt as to what it was going to mean. And this whole movement, obviously, this whole kind of movement of thought was celebrated by some as a liberation from superstition and prejudice. So people like Huxley, Thomas Huxley, thought that. And a German chap called Ernst Haeckel also very much welcomed this doubt as getting rid of everything that was wrong. But for most, in the 19th century, it was seen as a tragedy. And so, for example, the famous Liberal Prime Minister, William Gladstone, described it as an inexpressible calamity. And he was a Christian, but also non-Christians saw it as being something, as we've seen Matthew Arnold did, saw it as being something tragic. So, for example, the philosopher Henry Sidgwick, and those of you who know Cambridge, you go up and down the Sidgwick Avenue where all the humanities are, that's the Henry Sidgwick, because he's the guy who's responsible for helping the foundation of Newnham College. He said this: "I still hunger and thirst after orthodoxy, and he means by that Christian faith. But I am, I trust, not to barter my intellectual birthright for a mess, of mystical pottage." That's how he saw Christianity, a mess of mystical pottage. So in a sense, it was a story of bereavement. And you may think to yourself, well, my goodness, this was happening in the 19th century, but surely the 19th century was the great age of faith. That's when the churches were full. That's when, for example, in Cambridge in 1857, the great missionary, David Livingstone, came to the Senate House and had it absolutely packed and urged people to go out and evangelize Africa, which they did. The United University's Mission of Central Africa was founded as a result of that great meeting. So there was a huge amount of missionary work, and there was a lot of, there was in many ways genuine religious revival. There had been in the 18th century, and it carried on in the 19th century with people like Spurgeon, and then with the great missions of Moody and Sankey. In Cambridge, actually, they came here. Moody and Sankey were in Cambridge. William Heffer's The Bookshop here made his money selling Christian books at the Moody and Sankey Mission. or got going. And there were, in many ways, the 19th century was very much a church-going age. There was a tremendous reaction to the appalling sort of the atheism of the French Revolution. People had seen what that had led to when they had seen the high priest of reason being led into Notre Dame, in other words, in the form of an actress, and they'd then seen the guillotine and the 40,000 executions that had taken place. They saw, right, atheism maybe isn't such a good idea. So there were, many people reacted to that, and in some senses the Industrial Revolution also, there was a kind of all this modern modernity caused people to go back into church in many ways. So there was a lot of church going, and there was a lot of religious activity, and there was tremendous all sorts of religious reform in terms of social work and that kind of thing. And there was a lot of popular religious activity. But unfortunately, at the level of the intellectual elite, there was this huge amount of doubt, which was extremely important because that then had filtered down into society at large. And the thing, in some senses, was that Christians really didn't address those doubts as they were coming up. That was the tragedy. Now, okay, why was there this doubt? And when did it start? Well, I've said it's primarily a Victorian phenomena, but some people would argue that you could trace it back to the Renaissance and say that with the discovery, well, with the great discoveries of different cultures and the New World and that kind of thing, people became aware of other cultures, and that then made them start to think, well, you know, these people in India, they're Hindus, they think this. These people in China, they're Confucius, they think this. Are we right in thinking what we're thinking? So there was that element to it. There was also, perhaps, with the discoveries of Copernicus and Galileo, a shock to some people that they felt that if the Earth wasn't the center of the universe as they had understood it to be, or at least some people had understood it to be, if man was the pinnacle of creation, then surely, obviously, then shouldn't the Earth be the center of the universe? And it was a bit of a shock for people to find out that the sun was. That, for some people, was a kind of issue. Along with discovering about new cultures. And perhaps to some extent the whole, as it were, collapse of the Catholic Church as a result of the Reformation. and the emphasis upon individual inquiry, upon each individual deciding the truth for himself based upon what he was reading in the Bible, that had a tendency in some instances for people to say, well, I'm then become the arbiter of truth. I no longer accept authority. I no longer accept the dogma of the church. And so perhaps there was a sort of habit of mind. It's not a necessary one, of course, but it's just partly what happened. So you could say perhaps to some extent that the Renaissance, and I don't mean that the Reformation was responsible, but it could be used in that way, began to open or provide the seedbed in which doubt could take place. But I think perhaps the most important reason which led to a real kind of reconsideration of Christianity was the terrible religious wars of the 16th and 17th century. So that, for example, in France, many people in some senses claim that the secularism, the sort of hard-bitten secularism that you find in France, goes back in many ways to the appalling massacres and counter-massacres of the 16th century. You can think of the great Bartholomew massacre 1572, when 2,000 Huguenots were massacred in a night at the bequest of Catherine de' Medici, who was the Queen Mother in charge at the time. And people just think it was just a sort of bloodletting. Or you can think again, for example, of the terrible 30 Years' War in Germany from 1618 to 1648, an appalling war, primarily started as a result of religion. Though all sorts of political factors came into it as well. But the population of Germany was reduced by one half during those terrible wars. And people began to think, well, look, here we are fighting over religion. Does this make sense? We're fighting over really a few words. This is my body. What did those words mean? People were thinking. Because that was the heart of the doctrine of whether you understood the communion as being a memorial or whether you understood the communion as a Eucharist as being a kind of sacrifice. That's what people were arguing about. And people said, if we're fighting about this, and if this is causing all this much bloodshed, and if at the same time we're engaged in other things like, for example, the Salem witch trials in 692 and various other the persecution of witches or the burning of witches that took place, people were saying, surely this is absurd. And as a result of that, you began to get people thinking, well, maybe we shouldn't be looking at religion so much and shouldn't be looking at theology so much. Maybe there is something more impartial whereby we can discover truth. And they began to look to philosophy. Because it seemed as though philosophy was going to be relying on reason rather than revelation. And it seemed as though reason, they thought, naively, was going to be more impartial, was going to be kind of more objective. And that there wouldn't be the same kind of quarrels over rigorous rational thought as there had been over revelation, in other words, different interpretations of the Bible. And there was also a plea for toleration. So, for example, in 1689, you got John Locke, the philosopher, the English philosopher, writing a letter on toleration, making a plea for toleration, for intellectual toleration. And so, if you're writing notes, in a sense, the first major, in a sense, threat to Christianity or attack on Christianity came from philosophy in the 18th century. And of course, the 18th century is called the Age of Reason. It's called, quote unquote, the Enlightenment, supposedly. And that was the time when philosophy seemed to be replacing theology as the authoritative source of meaning. Okay? I ought to have said, in a sense, that it started earlier than that. Many people take it back to René Descartes, who wrote his Discourse on Method in 1637. When he was in Germany, he got himself, as you know the famous story, he sat above a warm stove in a little alcove and decided that he was going to doubt everything. He was going to spend all day doubting absolutely everything. He did so, apparently. Descartes was actually an informer for the French government, and that's why he was travelling around the countryside. As well as being a brilliant philosopher. He came up with the notion, I can doubt everything, but I can't doubt myself, and I can't doubt my own thinking. And therefore, cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am. That's the final source of reality. That's the foundation upon which I can base everything. And in a sense, he was actually a good Jesuit, background and education, and very much wanting to prove Christianity. But he wanted to find a rational foundation for it. And the danger was in looking purely for a rational foundation for Christianity, because it's not us who decides on the truth of Christianity, do you see? So in a sense, though he had a good motive, his method was wrong, because what he did was to introduce the notion that somehow truth is something that we human beings decide with our own reason. But the people who then actually used this method to discount Christianity were in the 18th century, as I was saying. And the two people perhaps most responsible for this is the Scotsman up in Edinburgh, David Hume. And then, of course, the German, or East Prussian, Immanuel Kant, over in Königsberg, in what is now, I think, Eastern Poland. And Hume wrote his book, Dialogue Concerning Natural Religion. Just notice the title, Dialogue Concerning Natural Religion, okay, and Treatise on Human Nature, and Inquiry on Concerning Human Understanding. These were the books that he wrote in the mid-18th century. And Kant wrote these books, The Critique of Pure Reason, don't try and write it all down, but maybe this one here, Religion Within the Limits of Reason Alone. That's by Immanuel Kant, and also his Critique of Practical Reason. And together, these two philosophers helped to demolish, at least in their view, and the view of many other people in the times, at the time, the traditional proofs for belief in the existence of God. And those traditional proofs, you may be familiar with them. For example, there's the cosmological proof. That's the idea that because the universe exists, it must have had a first cause. Nothing can exist without a cause. Therefore, there must have been a cause for the universe. And of course, that cause, people then said, must be God. Or there was the ontological proof, which was that this was Anselm's 12th century philosopher, his particular proof, which was that the highest thing that we can possibly conceive of must be God. Or is God. And since the highest thing that we possibly conceive of, since our conception must be always inferior to the reality must be greater than the idea, therefore God must exist. All right. Now, a lot of people say that's kind of presuming your conclusion based on your premise, if you see what I mean, that it's just a tautology, it's a circular argument. But I'm assured by philosophers today that it's still taken seriously. That non-Christians will actually say, well, let's look at what Anselm had to say, because there's something in there. And then the other major proof had been the teleological proof, which was really the proof of purpose and design. In other words, because we can discern that there is design in the universe, that therefore this design must presuppose some kind of designer, because there seems to be some sort of design, some sort of purpose. It's not a random universe, therefore there is a designer. Now, what I'm putting this horribly crudely, in a sense, or simply, but what, and if you want to look at it more, there's an excellent little book by Colin Brown called Philosophy and Christian Faith and Philosophy, I think it is. It's an IVP book. We've got it in the Vestry Library, and it's really clear. You don't have to have done philosophy or anything like that. It's not a totally simple book, but it's a very clear book. What Kant and Hume, in a sense, were to do were to say, well, those reasons may have some force to them, But they are not proofs in the sense that that is the only conclusion that you could possibly come to. So, for example, they would say on the designer, well, yes, there may be evidence of design, but that doesn't mean to say that there was a designer. Or with the first cause, well, yes, there may have been a first cause, but that doesn't make the first cause God. It could have been a prime mover or something else. Do you see? And the proofs that had been sort of brought, drawn up by Christians in the Middle Ages and later, they helped to undermine. Now, some people would say, actually, some Christians would say, and I think Colin Brown does in his book, he says that actually those reasons are good reasons, but they're not proofs. And they shouldn't be seen as proofs, and that it was wrong for Christians to try and make them out to be proofs. Do you see? They're not that, that the reason. They're not that they are reasons without some validity, but they're not by themselves proofs. But the point was that Kant and Hume, as it were, helped to undermine a kind of certainty, a sense that we've got proofs. You see, and of course they weren't the only ones. You may have heard of the great German philosopher Hegel, and he's the guy that introduced the notion of the dialectic. And the dialectic was really a notion that truth is seen to be something which unfolds through the process of history. Now, what he introduced was really the notion that truth is something which changes over time. That we don't have any kind of objective truth. And then there were others like Feuerbach, who were in, and Auguste Comte a little bit later in the 19th century, who were absolute out-and-out materialists. In other words, they said there is no supernatural. Now, they, to some extent, were basing themselves on what David Hume had argued for, which was that he was deeply, deeply skeptical about miracles. And he wrote extensively about miracles, saying that we really just don't happen. You just have to be credulous to believe that they do happen. And certainly what Hume had to say about miracles was something that really undermined people's belief in the supernatural. So it's the philosophers, in a sense, who in the 18th century help to undermine people's belief in the truth of Christianity. Okay? Then the second category of people, were more in the 19th century, and they were the scientists. They, if you're doing notes, they were, this is the kind of a next. The first bit was an introduction. The philosophers was kind of point one. This kind of point two, if you like. Okay, they were the scientists. They insisted that nature tell its own story rather than have its story told for it by the Bible or by the church. So nature must be examined without reference to anything else. That was their insistence. And perhaps most influential in this was a chap called Charles Lyell, L-Y-E-L-L, who wrote a book in 1836 called The Principles of Geology. And he basically said that the Earth has to be very old, that the stratas of rocks have to be, have been laid down over a very, very long period of time. That the formation of coal, for example, is something that could not have happened overnight, and that to attribute it to one flood is impossible from the deposits of one flood. And he was actually rather nervous about publishing his book. He delayed publication of it because he could see that it would have huge kind of implications. But what it did do was undermine people's belief in a very simple account of the Bible. So those people who had felt that Bishop Usher had been correct in saying that the Bible, that the earth had started in 4004 BC, those people who had taken that view, which the Bible doesn't claim, those people who had taken that view felt that their faith had been undermined. That a sort of simple reading of Genesis couldn't any longer be accepted. And for example, this had a big impact on someone like Ruskin, the great art critic who'd had an evangelical background. And he wrote this to her friend. You speak of the flimsiness of your own faith, he confided in his undergraduate contemporary and lifelong friend, the medic Henry Ackland, in 1851, when they were just 30. Mine, says Ruskin, mine, which was never strong, is being beaten into mere gold leaf. Has anyone seen gold leaf? Does anyone do artwork with gold leaf? You can blow it and it actually blows away. My wife's a calligrapher and she has gold leaf, and if you're not careful, if you breathe too loudly, if you put it by an open window, your gold will just disappear. Mine, which is never strong, is being beaten into mere gold leaf and flutters in weak rags from the letter of its old forms. But the only letters it can hold by at all are the old evangelical formulae. If only the geologists would let me alone, I could do very well. But those dreadful hammers, I hear the clink of them at the end of every cadence of the Bible verses. So this really made an impact on people at the time. Now what we're going to be doing at the end is looking at these reasons and saying, well, should they have taken them as seriously as they did take them? Because I don't think they should have done. And most people today would say they shouldn't have done. But they had a big impact at the time. And then, of course, the other person is Charles Darwin with his Origin of Species in 1859, which provided an alternative explanation for the origin of species, that natural selection rather than God was responsible for the different kinds of different species. It seemed to be full of impressive scholarship. And certainly, though Darwin initially was a theist, in his Descent of Man, which I think is about 1871, he seems to have become an agnostic. What's interesting is that the response to Darwin at the time was actually quite mixed. So, for example, Cardinal Newman didn't have any problem. He said, fine, evolution, I'll accept that. That I don't see that as being contradictory to the Bible. And then Benjamin Warfield, in America, who's one of the most solid evangelicals and absolutely strong on the Bible, said, I don't have a problem with it either. This is obviously how God made use. This is how God, as it were, created all the different kinds. It was through the whole thing of evolution. And also, at the same time, some scientists totally rejected it. So the great Harvard scientist, Louis Agassiz, said, I don't accept this at all. I don't think Darwin's right scientifically. So there was a different kind of response. It's interesting, at the time there was. But nonetheless, I think Darwin's ideas, particularly with the help of the man who was called Darwin's bulldog, that's Thomas Huxley. Huxley kept on pushing a kind of the secular conclusions that you might get from what Darwin had to say, much more so than Darwin did himself. Darwin was just very unsure. But Huxley very pushed it, and then as did Spencer, the philosopher, somebody you hear almost, nobody hears of Herbert Spencer anymore, but he was a sort of big noise in the 19th century, which is an important thing for you to realize. Don't necessarily take the authorities of your day as being the people whose views are going to last. It's interesting that despite what Darwin had to say, despite what Lyell had to say, that Francis Galton, who is a scientist, the person actually responsible for eugenics, the whole notion of eugenics, he did a survey of scientists at the time, a famous scientist at the time, and he found that 70% of them said that they were believers. So in other words, it hadn't been a major shift as a result of what people like Lyell and Darwin were saying. And he's looking at scientists like, I mean, not sort of just any old scientist, but people like Michael Faraday, Joule's, of Joule's Law, Herschel, Clerk Maxwell, and of course we all need to remember the other person who helped Darwin out of his difficulties, really, insofar that made Darwinism credible. That's George Mendel, the person who's responsible for understanding how genetics worked. He was an Austrian monk, for goodness sake. Without without Mendel's ideas, Darwin wouldn't have had a way in which natural selection could have been transmitted. And of course, Mendel was a Christian, or certainly a theist. So the scientists made a big impact on popular thinking, but don't think that they necessarily persuaded all the experts. They didn't. But they were the second kind of major set of reasons, apart from the philosophers. Then the third group of people were the Bible critics. And what they said is, let's just read the Bible as a book, like any other book. Let's not see it as a book that's got any kind of supernatural origins. Let's just examine it, criticize it as we would any other book. And they managed, for many people, to empty the Bible of any particular authority, or to prevent people seeing the Bible as in any way being special, or as in any way being a revelation. It was just fundamentally a book written by human beings, authored by human beings, claiming a revelation, but not actually having a revelation. And that you could, if you looked at the Bible, if you unpicked it and see how it was put together, you could see that it was authored like any other book. Lots of authors involved in it, but they were just writing within the tradition of, as it were, a supernatural revelation, but that was just their tradition. And the people who were most responsible for this is a chap called David Strauss, who wrote his book Das Leben Jesus in 1835, just the life of Jesus. And for him, Jesus was purely a myth to embody the good. He's just a symbol, in a sense, of the good. But rather than try and answer all the questions at the end, because I want to tell you this comment by A.N. Wilson, and I make no apology for saying that some of the books that I have based this lecture on come from this book here, A.N. Wilson, God's Funeral. A.N. Wilson is a superb writer. He's not a Christian at all, but he writes very objectively about it. Was the Dean of Emmanuel in Cambridge here, and this was a TV series, The Sea of Faith by Don Cupid. And he would claim to be a Christian, but it's difficult to see how he can justify that claim, because basically he believes almost nothing. It's a kind of existential belief. I mean, almost nothing. Then this is by a Christian called the Victorian World Picture, David Newsom. They're all thoroughly readable books. But what Wilson has to say about Strauss, because he immediately felt sort of the need, having talked about Strauss and his influence, was this. If I can find it. Wilson says this of Strauss. Strauss's agenda is made abundantly clear in the conclusion to his life of Jesus. And he says, there is little, quoting Strauss, there is little of which we can say for certain that it took place. And of all to which the faith of the church especially attaches itself, the miraculous and supernatural matter in the facts and destinies of Jesus, it is far more certain that it did not take place. That's Strauss. Okay. And then Wilson's comment. The shift in this sentence from agnosticism about New Testament evidences to an, in other words, I'm unsure about what the evidence is, I doubt it, to an a priori, in other words, that's where I start from, dogmatic assertion that no such evidence could ever exist, is an honest demonstration of Strauss's Hegelian viewpoint. In other words, this guy has decided in advance of his research that there can be no supernatural. Do you see? In other words, his philosophical premises have decided his conclusions. And this is Wilson, not a Christian at all, saying, for goodness sake, you know, treat Strauss's conclusions with a pinch of salt. Okay. But it's terribly, terribly tragic what the result of Strauss was. Because who was to translate his work into English from the German? Who had the competence to do so? Well, a young woman called Maria Evans. And who is Maria Evans? Now, there's somebody studying English from Durham here. Was it you, Sarah?
Yeah.
Who's Maria Evans? She hitched up with Henry Lewis. Another clue. She wrote Middlemarch.
George Eliot.
George Eliot. Right. Now, George Eliot's loss of faith came as a result, apparently, of reading Strauss's book, or of translating it. Tragic, because people wouldn't accept Strauss's conclusions today. Not only would they see, as Wilson says, that this guy was biased right from the beginning, but actually his scholarship is not scholarship which a lot of people would think is, you know, particularly credible. But there weren't the Christians able to answer Maria Evans, as she was then called. That was her name before she called herself George Eliot. There weren't the Christians around to do the job, you see. There weren't the scholars, the Christian scholars around. And you needed to be a scholar. So David Strauss was a crucial person. He was German and he was a Protestant. From the French side and from the Catholic side, there was a chap called Ernest Renan, R-E-N-A-N, who wrote A Vida Jesus, A Life of Jesus in 1863, which was a brilliant bestseller. Now, he took the view that Jesus was not a myth, but basically just a legend with some real parts to the legend. But it was a legend which had been embellished, as it were. But the result of these two writers in particular, and there were several others in different ways, was to encourage people to see Jesus as essentially just a great ethical teacher and the Bible just as a human book. Okay. And then other scholars, for example, the great German scholar Wellhausen, looking at the Old Testament, he said basically what we're seeing here is different sources that can make up the Old Testament. It's essentially a compilation coming from all sorts of different sources. It's the story of a tribal religion which is then internationalized by Paul. And if you look at it, you can see that it's an extraordinary book, full of great stories and all that, but nonetheless just really an account of a particular people, their kind of myths and stories. And that was his conclusion, which had a big impact. Now, even in the 19th century, there were people amongst the liberals, because the people who took this loose view of the Bible, who saw the Bible just as a human book, who saw Jesus as just a great sort of ethical teacher, we generally see them as being liberal theologians. They take a very free attitude to it, if you like, towards the Bible. They were criticized heavily by, I mean, it wasn't that the liberals all agreed amongst themselves. So, for example, Albert Schweitzer, the guy who was the great organist and Bible scholar and then missionary in the Congo, wrote in 1906 something called The Quest for the Historical Jesus, in which he hammered people like Strauss and Renan. Not so much that he disagreed with their scholarship, but he said the picture that they give of Jesus is entirely false. The picture of him just being a humanist scholar, a humanist teacher, a great kind of ethical teacher. He said that's just not something which can be regarded as credible. And then particularly after the First World War, Karl Barth, though again he didn't question all aspects of their scholarship, and in fact he accepted some of the premises, some of their conclusions of the scholarship, in other words that it was just a book which you couldn't be sure of its factuality. The Bible wasn't a book which you couldn't be sure of its factuality. Nonetheless, he said, the picture that these people give is completely inadequate. It's not it's not fair to what the Bible is actually saying. Because after the First World War, people didn't really believe that Western culture had been inspired by this ethical teacher, namely Jesus, because they thought to themselves, well, it's quite clear that having an ethical teacher behind your culture isn't adequate after you've just had the First World War, in which people have been slaughtering each other. You know, that's an entirely inadequate basis. In other words, the kind of Christianity that that represents isn't going to stop people slaughtering each other. If it is not going to stop people slaughtering each other, it's an inadequate type of Christianity. And people like Barth said, we have to believe in sin, we have to believe in redemption, that's what we have to believe in. We have to go back to a kind of orthodoxy and not accept this kind of this liberal theology. And there were also other people in the 19th century who were critical of the scholarship. And it's not inappropriate that we're actually in Westcote House, because there were people in the 19th century, including Westcote, after whom this place is named, who were all Cambridge scholars, Westcote, Lightfoot and Hort, who were undermining some of the German higher criticism, say we don't have to accept all the conclusions. I don't think you could say that they were completely evangelical in the way that we would have perhaps liked to be, but nonetheless, they maintained the orthodoxy of the biblical revelation, or went a long way to help sustain that. But nonetheless, even though there were the liberal critics of what people like Strauss and Renan had been saying, and even though there were other people who were questioning their scholarship, nonetheless, the overall effect of what they had to say percolated down into the culture, and people began to see the Bible as just a human book. You know, I don't have to take it seriously. Okay, so those are the third group of people. The fourth group of people are the writers. Now, the writers are a very wide range of different people who had all sorts of different reasons for undermining the truth of Christianity. And all sorts of... but basically, I think perhaps you could say what they did was to question Christian morality. Question that Christianity was the expression of the highest good. So, for example, it really started in the 18th century with a chap called Edward Gibbon, who's the guy who wrote The Decline and Fall of the Holy Roman of the Roman Empire. The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire in the 1770s to 1788. He was a kind of urbane Enlightenment deist, a deist was somebody who sort of held on to the belief in God, but really just thought God had set everything up in the beginning and then was uninterested in the universe that he had set up. So you needed God to set the thing going, but after that you could sort of more or less forget him. And he rather took the view that when he compared the ancient world of Greece and Rome with the world of then Christendom, he compared the world of Christendom rather unfavorably. He felt that really the culture of Greece and Rome was superior to the culture of medieval Christianity. And for example, he doubted the amount of... He made quite a bit of doubting the martyrs of the early church. Not that he dismissed it entirely as from having happened, but sort of doubted the extent to which it happened For the most, you know, he mocked the lives of the saints, for example, the sorts of lives of the saints that people like the Venerable Bede had produced in his History of England, of the English Church at least. And he sort of said, well, we don't really have to take this very seriously. So he kind of doubted, really, the track record of the church. So that was Edward Gibbon. Then I mentioned just earlier Maria Evans or George Eliot. And there's a fascinating... quote here, having given up her faith, I'll just read what Wilson has written here. In the end, some of George Eliot's contemporaries found her insistence upon a position of unbelief somewhat arid. The most famous instance of this occurs in the mellifluous essay in the Century magazine by F.W.H. Myers, who describes himself walking with the great lady, George Eliot, in the Fellows' Garden of Trinity College, Cambridge, on a rainy evening. And this is what he wrote. She stirred somewhat beyond her wont, and taking as her text the three words which have been used so often as the trumpet calls of men, the words God, immortality, duty, pronounced with terrible earnestness, How inconceivable was the first, namely God? How inconceivable. How unbelievable was the second, namely immortality? And yet, how peremptory and absolute was the third, namely duty? In other words, you hold on to duty. Never, perhaps, have sterner accents affirmed the sovereignty of impersonal and unrecompensing, unrewarding law. Never, perhaps, have sterner accents affirmed the sovereignty of impersonal and unrecompensing law. I listened, and night fell. Her grave, majestic countenance turned towards me like a sibyl's in the gloom. It was as though she withdrew from my grasp, one by one, the two scrolls of promise, and left me the third scroll only, awful with inevitable fates. And when we stood at length and parted amid the columnar circuit of the forest trees, beneath the last twilight of starless skies, I seemed to be gazing like Titus at Jerusalem on vacant seats and empty halls. Titus was the guy who destroyed Jerusalem in AD 70. On a sanctuary with no presence to hallow it, and heaven left lonely of a god. These guys could write, couldn't they? At least I think so. But heaven left lonely of a god. So in other words, the interesting thing is, no God, no immortality, but we've got duty. Why? And Nietzsche, when he heard this, he just said, she's a silly woman. silly woman. And Nietzsche was smarter than she was, I'm afraid. Okay, so there were writers like George Eliot. Then there were people like John Stuart Mill, the great philosopher of the mid-19th century, who could not abide the doctrine of hell or judgment. Right, I'll just hurry up. He just couldn't hack it at all. He just said, I cannot believe in anything which holds to that kind of point of view. And the same was true of a chap called A.J. Froude in his Nemesis of Faith. Very much took the same view that anything that Christian judgment was inconceivable and incompatible with any notion of the Christian idea of judgment was inconceivable and incompatible with the notion of a good God. And then William Blake, for example, regarded the atonement as a horrible doctrine. How can somebody else die for you, for your sin? How appalling, how unjust. How could God possibly do that, was William Blake's attitude. So these people, in a sense, attacked the goodness of God. There were then those who kind of attacked the absurdity of Christian belief. And I think, I don't know if you are familiar with the writer Edmund Gosse, who wrote a book in 1907 called Father and Son. And his father had been a famous marine biologist who had been a very much a literal creationist, who had held on to the notion of a very literal creation. He was the person who had said that the God had created the trees old. That's why they had the rings in them. As a way of coping with a kind of instant creation, which had been laughed at the time. But that wasn't what Gosse was interested in. He wasn't interested in his father's ideas. He was interested in his father's kind of legalism. And his father had been a Plymouth Brethren man, and like the Puritans of the 17th century, he had felt that Christmas was a crime, that Christmas was a Catholic superstition, and you shouldn't practice it. And so that in his house, he forbade any celebration of Christmas. Now, Edmund Gosse, the young boy, recounts in his book how he went downstairs on Christmas Day and found in the kitchen the two cooks had made secretly and illegally a Christmas pudding. And the two cooks had said, "Dear boy, come here, would you like a piece of Christmas pudding?" You see. And the boy thought, well, his father's upstairs, he don't get to see. So he had a bit of Christmas pudding, which was absolutely delicious. But then when he left the room, he was absolutely smitten with guilt. And he ran up the stairs and said to his father, "I have eaten the food offered to idols." Now that's the kind of culture he was brought up in, do you see? A sort of legalism which was tragic, dreadful. His father came storming down the stairs into the kitchen, got hold of the Christmas pudding, shouted at the maids, went outside, and there was where the coals, what's the stuff left over from coals? You know, yeah, the cinders from the house fires were still sort of burning away. Shoved the Christmas pudding deep into the cinders so it could completely be burnt. And I mean, when Goss looked back on that later on in life, he just thought, crazy. You know, how could anyone be like that? And so he kind of represented to people that Christianity was kind of legalistic and crazy. And then there were people like the great poet Algernon Swinburne, small, red-haired aristocrat. He's the person famous for that phrase, "Thou hast conquered, O pale Galilean. The world has grown grey from thy breath." He was the person that depicted Christianity as being something which was life-denying, life-destroying. Which is a bit ironic, because poor old Swinburne was a total drug addict, you know, and died in a little suburban villa on drugs, on opium. But he depicted to four people. He's the person who always said, also, "Glory to man in the highest, for man is the master of all things." And Swinburne, so in other words, he sort of described Christianity as being narrow, but it sort of struck a chord. But it struck a chord, really, not only was his own life a complete mess and disaster, so in some senses people shouldn't have listened to what he had to say, but it struck a chord because in some senses it wasn't what true Christianity is about, and it relates to that question about making Christianity attractive. It was about what some aspects of a Victorian Christianity had become. It had become grey and legalistic and that kind of thing. Some of you can think of perhaps examples of that. I remember going to a home of an uncle of mine who the idea that one should swim like on a day like yesterday on a Sunday was absolute anathema. Absolute anathema, that we should even consider as children to go down to the beach. You know, that was so worldly that we just didn't dare. Do other people have that? Anyway. So, it was that kind of mentality. So the writers, they used every opportunity, in a sense, to undermine Christianity. And there are other people like Shelley and Byron and Thomas Hardy and Bernard Shaw and not least a chap called Lytton Strachey, who wrote a book called Eminent Victorians. He wrote about people like General Gordon and Florence Nightingale who'd been regarded as great Christian heroes, and he sort of undermined them. Debunked them was the phrase. So that people thought, well, the great people that we believed in the past, well, maybe they weren't quite so great, you see. So these were some of the kind of the writers who attacked Christianity. Then there were the ideologues, people like Karl Marx with his Communist Manifesto, 1848, and his Das Kapital, 1867. For him, religion was just an instrument of social control. Religion was the opium of the people. It was a way of pacifying unrest among the poor by offering them pie in the sky and heaven. It was a way of legitimizing an unjust social order, the rich man in his castle, the poor man at the gate. And a lot of people thought, right, he's because there's a certain truth in that, they forget the fact that who were the people in the vanguard of social reform in the 19th century? Well, it was Christians. Who had liberated the slaves? Well, evangelical Christians. But he forgot all that, or ignored it. Then, apart from the ideologues like Marx, there were the psychologists, and particularly Freud, with his General Introduction to Psychoanalysis in 1915 to 1917. He saw religion as a neurosis, prompted by an attempt to deal with our sexuality, and as a crutch to deal with life, to help us cope with life. That's what religion is. It's just a crutch. And that we invent a father figure, we project a father figure of God because we need to have a father figure. But it's just a projection. Now, nobody, seriously, nobody believes in Freud today in terms of him as a scientist or him as a psychologist. Yes, he was a hugely important figure in terms of, as it were, making us think psychologically. But I was just reading recently that the actual term neurosis is no longer in the American Psychiatric Dictionary. because nobody accepts his description of the way the mind works and the way the person operates as being true. Psychoanalysis is itself not regarded as a particularly helpful therapy. And then perhaps another factor, which is not so much a kind of intellectual movement, was just a whole kind of social process, was the process of secularization. In the sense that it wasn't so much, in other words, particular ideas, but it was the kind of context in which people found themselves. They found themselves in an industrial revolution in which people were now living in cities, in which wealth was produced by factories from machines. And this whole industrial urban world seemed very far removed from the rural world of the Bible, with all its pastoral images, sheep, the vine, the tree of life, and all this kind of thing. It somehow seemed removed and far away from it, and therefore you couldn't take it as being credible. And then perhaps the single most devastating impact on Christianity was just the fact of the First World War. There you had people on both sides praying for victory and praying for the safety of their sons in a world which, in a war which most people regarded as, well, now we look back on and think, how could the European nations have been so insane? How could they have just engaged in this industrial slaughter? And if you want to read a book about that, Robert Graves' book, Goodbye to All That, is absolutely superb, in which he catches the sense. There's a guy who, there's a wonderful scene, tragic scene of a young man who's been shot in the stomach and suddenly realizes, finally sort of realizes, he is not just wounded, he is going to die. There's nothing that can be done for him. And he starts to curse God and shout against heaven. It's a tragic, tragic scene. And then also, if you see the great 1920s film, All Quiet on the Western Front, if you've not seen that as part of your film career, you must see it, All Quiet on the Western Front. So the First World War was really devastating. And perhaps the last reason that one could perhaps mention is that the evangelicals, by and large, failed to provide the answers to the issues and questions that were being raised. The Christian church, in some senses, failed. And it was tragic in some ways, because what were most of the Christians doing, some of the most brilliant and some of the most active and committed Christians? Well, they were around the world evangelizing the world and forgetting, in fact, perhaps, well, we ought, some of us, to be staying at home. I was not saying that what C.T. Studd and people and Hudson Taylor were doing was wrong, but we needed to have people back also, as it were, protecting what was happening at home. And that's why, in a sense, we need to have Christian scholars. We really need to have people who can deal with the questions and the of the scholars. Okay, I think that's all I want to say for now. That's the kind of the picture. We've got 20 minutes. What about some questions? Do we think any of the Do we think any of the reasons that these guys that I have laid out, were they decisive reasons? Were they reasons which we should still take into account, or do we think that we have some sort of answer to some of these reasons? Now, some of the answers I've mentioned already. But for example, in relation to the philosophers, what would you say? Yeah, Ross.
Possibly say none of the objections were necessarily conclusive, mm-hmm. but also likewise we can't give any conclusive rebuttals.
I think in some instances we can give reasonably conclusive rebuttals. In relation to philosophy, I think that's more difficult.
Yeah.
Though what is absolutely fascinating now is that if you go to America, you will find, I have a friend who teaches philosophy in America, and he says that whenever he goes to a philosophy conference, there are more Christians, or at least a substantial number of Christians, in the philosophy departments in the States, and also to some extent over here, that that people like Alvin Plantinga and are taken really seriously, who's at Notre Dame University and who's very much a Christian, who came to give a whole bunch of lectures here last year. The Divinity Department invited him over and treated him very respectfully, and Plantinga was able to, at the highest intellectual level, also be comfortably, quite clearly, a Christian. And the extraordinary, wonderful thing is, there was a Chinese guy there who's now doing a PhD who had lost his faith at a theological college in Singapore, and he said, listening to Plantinga, he was able to regain his faith. This is wonderful. Because he thought, here is somebody who really understands these things, who's got real answers. And basically, Plantinga was talking about the fact that if you're a naturalist, in other words, if you think that nature is all there is, you really can't do science, which is interesting. But so I would say that, yes, people take Hume and Kant very seriously still, secular people, and would use him. But I think there are other folk, there are other Christian philosophers who'd say, well, no, I don't think we have to take what these people say as seriously. What they perhaps would say is that is the kind of belief that some folk put on the traditional proofs, as it were, is misplaced. In other words, though those arguments are still used as being pretty by some people, J.P. Moreland, for example, and some American evangelical philosophers, would still say those proofs, quote unquote, you know, have still got a lot of merit to them, but perhaps not as final proofs, knockdown proofs. What about the science? We're going to look at that tomorrow to some extent, but you'll find people who will have, you know, there are different views we're going to see, I think, tomorrow. There are going to be Christians still have different views, and perhaps we're in a period of history when Christians do have different views about the relationship between the science and the Bible, relationship between science and Christianity. But nonetheless, there are lots and lots of heavyweight scientists who have no problem at all with combining their Christian faith with heavyweight science. In this university here, for example, the professor of geology, Bob White, the guy who was head of the Babram Institute until recently, who's now head of the Faraday Institute, Dennis Alexander. These people are, you know, front rank scientists. Another guy, Simon Conway Morris, not perhaps an evangelical, but very much argued for the historicity of the resurrection in Great St. Mary's not long ago. Absolute top rate scientist.
Can I just say one thing?
Yeah.
One thing I've heard before, mm-hmm. is, like, in terms of, like, allowing your Christian belief to be flexible and kind of to reassess in, mm-hmm. terms of, like, you know, scientific discovery and, mm-hmm. say, well, okay, you know, look at my faith. Do I really have to hold on to this, mm-hmm. idea that I've held? Mm-hmm. Can I learn something from this new discovery or, mm-hmm. something like that? You know, mm-hmm. in, you know, previous centuries, maybe, mm-hmm. things like the Earth being old and, mm-hmm. evolution and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But in doing so, there's the criticism that you're just changing the goalposts or something like that.
Yes, I think that's a fair criticism, except that the people who would say that, who would be evangelical, these people I've been talking about, at least people like Bob White and Dennis Alexander, are thoroughly evangelical. They would say that the kind of understanding that people had of the Bible in the 19th century was an over-literalistic understanding, which was not held by the church in all times of history. For example, they would quote Augustine and they'd quote Calvin to say that that's not the view of the Bible that these people took. So they quote heavy authorities back in the past, a long way back in the past, who said that the 19th century sort of view of a simplistic six-day creation, a necessary six-day creation, is not what these other folk understood Genesis to mean. Do you see what I mean? So in other words, they're saying, we're not changing the goalposts now. This was something that people didn't understand a way back. There is an uncomfortableness about not being perhaps entirely certain about what Genesis is saying in all aspects, in the same way as perhaps we're entirely not completely certain of what Revelation is saying. We see there's history in Revelation, future history, past history in Genesis, but exactly what the nature of that history is, both future and past, is perhaps most of us would agree we're not completely clear on. Do you see what I'm saying? Not denying the history at all. Okay, what about the Bible critics?
Just a bit of a comment on this.
Yeah, please do. Hmm.
And this is sort of rambling because it's just sort of forming in the mind, really. But
yeah.
We often seem to be on the back foot and scared in terms of science when we talk about it. And just, I was just fascinated just to be reminded from what you said about the Christian worldview sort of propelled and gave motivation to.
Oh, absolutely.
And I just wonder, in terms of, just thinking what Jock was saying yesterday about worldviews, about whether we should stop always being on the back foot and embarrassed. Remember, you know, the history of the Christian of Christianity, which led to these developments, and actually start putting other people's worldview to test, and just, you know, taking that to its logical end. So I just wonder if that's what that Plantica did. You know, saying if you really believe this, why do you bother? You know, what motivations and reasons do you actually have to do the scientific inquiry? Whereas our worldview gives us lots, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, that's what Jock was saying yesterday when he was referring to Schaefer about taking the roof off, was pushing people back to the logic of their presuppositions and asking them, well, do you actually, can you hold what you say you hold when you actually hold these presuppositions? And so in a sense, well, with looking at worldviews, one of the things one's wanting to do is get into a situation where, as Christians, we're not always answering the questions. We're asking the questions. And not in a hostile way, not in an aggressive way, but in a helpful way. You know, look, guys, let me ask you some questions. Rather than always sort of assuming that we're on the back foot, as you say, which is not the right stance to be on.
So
Jesus wasn't on the back foot.
Why did he say, just thinking about Plantica when he came over, why did he say that if you were... naturalist, why do you want to do science?
Well, you don't have an epistemology if you're a naturalist, ultimately, he was saying. You don't have a basis for understanding for knowledge, essentially. Because if you're a naturalist, if you believe that nature is all in, if you believe that the brain is just neurons firing, how do you know that the brain is telling you any truth? If that's what you believe, how can you be sure that the brain is telling you any kind of reliable truth? It's just neurons firing. I mean, that's putting it horribly crudely, but, you know, essentially that.
Has Plantinga written anything that you'd recommend?
Plantinga?
Yes.
We've got some stuff in the Vestry Library. He's written a book called Warranted Christian Belief. I won't promise it's easy reading, but worth looking at. Anyone else?
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm a bit puzzled about this world view sort of attitude about Christians being marginalised. I feel at the moment that a lot of people are unhappy with the word God. And there's a more sort of spiritual element coming in, that people are looking for something spiritual.
That's absolutely, I think that's absolutely true.
Well,
no, I think our culture is, and Jock will be mentioning this, is looking for a kind of spirituality. Okay, and one of the absolutely ironic things of the late 19th century, as Christian belief was attacked and undermined, was the what we can only describe as pathetic credulity of so many intelligent people in all sorts of nonsense. So they started to, it became really fashionable to go into seances in the 19th century. Poor old people like Conan Doyle were deeply into things like that. Madame Blavatsky and all the kind of stuff that she came up, Gurdjieff, all this kind of Eastern stuff that people started to believe in. In other words, when people started to disbelieve in Christianity, they started to believe in all sorts of other stuff, which was far, far more incredible. So, I mean, that was just one of the facts of the 19th century. You look at the career of people like Annie Besant, and the whole kind of emphasis on spiritualism that people had. It was really quite extraordinary. And that is something which A.N. Wilson recognizes. He said, you know, what people got into, and not a Christian, what people started to believe in and investigate and inquire in was pretty odd, really, given that there was supposedly rational grounds for giving up Christianity. was irrational grounds for accepting all sorts of other things. But I think that in relation to your question, that what one has to ask oneself is, do I want just some impersonal spirituality? Just some sense that my life has transcendence, has meaning, has a kind of lasting purpose? Or do I actually want to know that there is a personal God behind everything who cares for me and who cares for this world and has redeemed this world? And I think that's, in a sense, the difference of worldview. I'm not interested ultimately in an impersonal spirituality. You know, I can go and hug a tree, it's not going to hug me back. But even if I believe the tree is transcendent, I mean, that's not a good example, but it's a, you know, slightly poor example, I agree. But I want, ultimately, I want a worldview which presupposes not only a God who is infinite, but a God who is personal. God who is adequate for everything, for my own death, my own sin. But also, who loves me and loves us all. Any other points about the writers? Well, we did the Bible critics I mentioned. Did anyone want to? Yes, Martin.
Can I still make a point about philosophers and scientists?
Yes, please do.
Okay. I thought it would be useful to mention there is a not very well-known group of German physicists. They made a big point regarding Kant, because Kant has put reason as the origin of all things, as the highest thing. Mainly, you could say, he has put it as God.
Yeah.
And one thing he has written about was that we should start thinking from the natural axioms, that is, that space and time is given, and we cannot doubt space, the space around us and the time. And this is, of course, what was very much, let's say, it was proved to be wrong by the theory of relativity by Albert Einstein.
Mm-hmm.
And this theory of relativity is well proved today. It's commonly accepted
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
by everybody besides a small group of physicists in Germany who, on the basis of Kant's idea that we should start from the absolute space of our thinking and from absolute space, reviewed relativity on this basis, because they say this is our basis of thinking. So I think this tells us that first Kant's absolute reason has been proved wrong,
right?
Even in its application by science, and that science is not always against the terms of Christianity.
Right. So in other words, you have some Kantian fundamentalists in Germany still.
Yes.
Right. Yes.
Could you repeat that for the tape, please, if possible?
Ah, yes. Martin was saying that there are some physicists in Germany who still hold to Kant's notions of the absoluteness of space and time, which has been disproved by relativity, the theory of relativity. Therefore, to some extent, Kant's own theories have been disproved, and it's really odd that the Kantian fundamentalists should still exist, but they do. Okay. Bible critics. Anyone want to say anything about that or ask any questions about that? Do they think that what they had to say was decisive? Do we think that the Bible is just a human book? Peter Williams, hopefully on Friday, will answer some of these questions. Yes, Alice.
I don't think it's decisive, but last week Kosher was saying that there's such an literacy about the Bible today,
yep.
which is why these kind of things really resonate.
Yep.
Like the Gospel.
Yep.
People just don't know.
Right.
So talking about it just being a book or so many authors, it's not really a revelation or anything. It's really kind of comical.
Right.
And these are the things that these are resonant.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. How many people have heard of the book called Redating the New Testament by John Robinson? Okay, one of the things about being able to trust the Bible is that the Bible, particularly the New Testament, we're talking about that, and that's talking about Jesus, should have been written fairly closely to the time of the events described in the New Testament. If the Bible, or if the New Testament was written at the end of the second century, you know, 150 years after Jesus' death, plus, 150 years plus, well then it's more likely, which is what a lot of people say, used to say, more likely that mistakes, errors, legends, additions from the early church could have been added, do you see? However, if the Bible has been written within the lifetime of people who were contemporaries of Jesus, it's much more difficult for those kinds of embellishments, myths, legends, etc., to be added. Yeah? So if we can show that the New Testament has been written pretty early, that's not proof, but that increases the probability of it being believable and credible. Okay? Now, John Robinson, in his book Redating the New Testament, and he was a liberal theologian in many ways, in his theology he was, but in his biblical scholarship, interestingly, he was pretty conservative. And he said, redating the New Testament, the Now, if that's the case, if guys had been writing after AD 70, they would have said, we told you so. Jesus told you and warned you, and look, it's happened. But the fact, Robinson argues, that no mention is made of it is because it's still going to happen. And I heard a very interesting discussion at the European Leaders Forum, which is an apologists forum in which Greg Pritchard, you may have seen Greg running this PhD's scholars network. He runs this great big conference out in Hungary for people from Eastern and Western Europe all to get together. There's a German scholar there, historian, saying that this is increasingly a view which Bible critics in Germany are having to accept, that the New Testament really does seem to have been written fairly early. Now, they don't necessarily say it's true, but that means that it's, you see, that it's more difficult to say that you've added a whole lot of stuff to it. So, okay, that's just one example of the kind of, there's lots of others. If you look at Craig Blomberg's book on, you must all of you read F.F. Bruce's book about the reliability of the New Testament documents. If you haven't read that, that's bad. It's a little short book. You must read that book. And then there's other Craig Blomberg's book on the reliability of the Gospels, and you can find them in the Vestry Library. 2 minutes. The writers, I think, mostly were referring to the 19th century culture. They referred to that culture. On things, they were sort of criticizing the Christianity of the time, not actually biblical Christianity. Though we can look at the issue of judgment. Christian?
I found a lot of Christian people here in Cambridge. They think you can find in the Bible a lot of myths. Even when I was studying Rudolf Bultmann's
Oh, yeah.
A young German theologian.
Yeah.
And he spoke, you can find a lot of myth.
Yeah.
You can to take off the myth and you will find really the Bible.
Right.
So, and even last week I was reading the book by C.S. Lewis, The Problem of Pain, and he said the magic apple, you know? Talking
right.
About the hidden. So, even some people told me when he came and said, do you believe in Adam, you know?
Yeah.
Even the floods, everything. I said, yeah, it's cool.
Mm-hmm.
So I think this position, liberal position, is very strong. It's very strong in evangelical circles.
Among some, there is a softness on some aspects. Yeah.
The main problem is they don't have answer.
Mm-hmm.
When you have to ask answer about evil,
mm-hmm.
about something like that,
mm-hmm.
about they don't have historical point of view really.
Mm-hmm.
If another thing, if we have to take up, if there is some myth in the Bible,
mm-hmm.
so what is true, what is wrong?
Right.
How can I say what is true, what is wrong?
Mm-hmm.
So I have to use my reason.
Mm-hmm.
That is my... You know, that's my instrument to say that is right,
mm-hmm.
that is wrong. So I think that's very dangerous.
It can be. It can be. That's certainly true. But I think we certainly not everything that is the Bible contains all sorts of we can deal with this on Friday with when you're talking with Peter Williams, because he's the expert, but not all of the Bible is dealing with automatic sort of literal truth. So for example, I think that when it's referring to in Revelation, you'll see the Son of Man coming and he will have a two-edged sword coming out of his mouth. I think that's a picture. Or when, for example, Jesus is saying to people, if your hand offends you, cut it off.
Yeah, I know. There are some...
That's a picture.
Some figures. Yeah. And double more precision.
Yeah.
But that's a different kind of
thing. Right, I agree. Yeah. No, I mean...
That's a different...
Right.
That's kind of literature. It's poetry.
Yeah.
It's,
yeah, yeah.
That's historical. That's
right. Okay. Now, I think we do have to become fairly... We do have to become a bit more sophisticated and thoughtful and informed on the Bible. I certainly think that's vital. But I think at the same time, we don't have to concede absolute basic truths. Sorry, somebody, I think you were asking, yes.
Yeah, I'm interested on your view. You stopped at World War One.
Yeah.
What would you say were significant influences of the secularisation of society in the 20th century?
I think it was just a continuation, in a sense, of what has happened so far. That what had happened previously. Though, in some senses, what's more interestingly recently is that some sociologists are now saying, well, no, actually, the kind of secularization that we thought was inevitable isn't taking place because here we are living in a world of fundamentalist Islam and Christian America. So religion is much more vital than we ever thought it was going to be. So perhaps the sort of secularization thing is just a sort of particular phase in history. One of the really interesting points that one can make is when people talk about, for example, the wrong things Christianity has done, or they like to associate with Christianity, crusades, witchcraft, whatever, the religious wars, is to, and this relates to what we've been talking about today, is what happened when Europe gave up Christianity? What happened as a result of the secularization that we've been talking about? What did Europe replace it with? What happened in the 20th century? What did it replace religion with? It replaced it with ideology. It replaced it with fascism, Nazism, and communism. And they did more to kill people, slaughter people, than Christianity could ever have alleged to have done. Do you see what I mean? And people don't actually remember that. They don't just sort of face that. Sorry, was there any other questions? Everyone feeling they must have a question? Otherwise we must have tea and coffee. Well, it's a no-brainer. Tea and coffee. Okay.